Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. This is part two of our podcast on fermented and cultured foods. We're talking to an expert. She's Cynthia Layer, and she's author of Feeding the Whole Family, a popular book with more than 77,000 copies sold. She is also a teacher of nutrition and cooking at Bastyr University in Seattle, Washington, and a culinary curriculum director for their Bachelor of Science program over there. So, Cynthia, how do people get started? Give us some simple tips and tools and some simple recipes so that people can try this out on their own.
Sure. Well, I think the first thing that you want to do is look at what do you gravitate toward. You know, what sounds good to you? Does yogurt sound good to you? Does creme fraiche sound good to you? Do you love miso soup when you go out? Is sourdough bread something that you've always wanted to make, or do you just really like kraut and pickles? You know, just kind of what sounds good to you, rather than what do you think will, you know, is the mental idea of what you would want to make. And then once you have...
So this is not a hold your nose and, kind of proposition where, the worse it tastes, the better it is for you.
Right. Well, nobody wants to eat like that. And so once you've kind of gone, okay, I'm going to do this, then you can get started. And I think one of the easiest things to do is to start with sauerkraut, yogurt, or miso soup. All of those are really easy, and the easiest of those probably would be miso soup, because you can buy really excellent quality unpasteurized miso at a health food store or a whole food store or something like that, and it's pretty easy to make miso soup. You know, basically you're making some kind of a stock, hopefully a dashi stock, which has some strange ingredients in it, like kombu, which is a seaweed.
I used to eat a ton of that.
Flakes. Yeah. Yeah. But it's not hard.
That's the seaweed that's sort of the flat kind of seaweed that's in it.
Yeah,
it's not in sheets, right. But it looks like sort of a cooked strip of bacon. You know, it's stiff,
yeah,
and then it needs to be reconstituted in water. Yeah, right.
Yeah. And kombu and bonito flakes, which is literally shaved fish,
mm-hmm,
is what makes a traditional dashi stock.
Yeah, that gives a it gives a great flavor, though, just a little bit of bonito flakes.
Yeah, that kind of smoky flavor.
Yeah.
But the hardest part of that is just going, you know, finding the right store to buy those ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you've made that simple dashi stock, all you do is stir some miso into it. You don't want to heat it to boiling.
Right. Yeah, rookie mistake. You know, people, you know, say, well, let me turn it on to medium heat,
yeah,
and I'll just boil the hell out of it. No, right? There's a reason for that. What's the reason?
Yeah, so when we make it in class, I have students put the miso in their bowl and then add the broth and stir it. And that way there's no chance of it getting above boiling.
So it's a live culture. You're getting it heated but not annihilated.
Right, right. And then from there, you know, if you want to put little bits of tofu in there or little ribbons of bok choy or, you know, whatever you like, but just the broth itself is easy to make and very healing.
Right. Great on a cold winter afternoon.
Yes. Yeah, I think more people might want to try that miso soup for breakfast, because it will perk your day up better than a lot of things.
Better than a bowl of cornflakes with skim milk and and a couple of tablespoons of sugar.
Yeah, which you've just described something that's so hard to digest.
Mm-hmm.
Not only is it hard to digest, but it's going to take away from your overall gut digestibility, especially with the sugar. So, yeah, we eat so many foods that instead of helping our digestion, they actually hurt it. And, you know, yogurt is pretty easy to make. Some people like to buy yogurt makers or something like that. But I have a jar, and you need a thermometer, and then you need some milk. The only tricky part about making yogurt is, and this is kind of sad, but nowadays it's kind of hard to find milk that's not ultra-pasteurized.
Yeah.
And a lot of the organic milks are ultra-pasteurized, and when they are...
They're organic, they're not natural,
yeah,
in the sense they're pasteurized. Well, when you teach your class, what does pasteurization do to the quality of the milk? How does it get changed? I mean, it kills the bacteria, and that you would say, well, okay, I'll take the milk. I'd rather not have the bacteria, thank you very much, especially if it's dangerous. But what does it do to alter the properties of the milk?
Well, it kills everything. So if I were to go milk a cow and then drink the milk, there would be some natural enzymes in that milk that would help me digest the food. And there would be some good bacteria in there as well that would help me digest that food.
Possibly some antibodies that are transferred from the mother cow to the calf that enhance the immune system that actually could transfer to human immunity.
Yeah, but let me make it clear that you don't want to just go out and start drinking raw milk. The pasteurization of the milk is there for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Especially with the big industrialized milk production, wouldn't be. You know, these they're small artisanal places that really specialize in this, but it's really quite a craft, and it can't usually be replicated on an industrial level. So the mass production of milk kind of goes against that.
Yes, I if somebody tells me they want to drink raw milk, I said, well, you better be on a first name basis with the cow.
Okay, there you go.
Really have met the cow, looked at the cow inside and upside down. So but regular pasteurized milk will ferment into yogurt, but the ultra-pasteurized, which is a higher heat and kills off even more, you can't get it to turn into yogurt or cream.
Interesting.
Fresh.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Was something that's denatured out of it.
Yeah, yeah. So you just heat the milk and you heat it to 180, and you cool it down to 110, stir a tablespoon of already developed yogurt in there, and then it needs to set in a warm place. I use one of those lunch totes, those big lunch totes. I think it's actually made for a six-pack of beer or something.
Hmm.
And then I put a couple of jars of warm... of hot water in there and a blanket or a towel, and it keeps it warm in there. Other people use ovens or, you know, various things to keep it warm, but it does need to stay at around 78.
How long does it take? Because what happens is you actually break the lactose down, and if you're lactose intolerant, if you don't ferment your milk for long enough, you'll get a substantial amount of lactose left over that hasn't been broken down, and that can still cause you to have intolerance. So how long do you have to let it set to get the bacteria to completely break down the lactose?
Right. Well, it's going to depend on the temperature and how well you've created an environment for that to happen. But usually 8 hours is plenty to do that. But you need to be, I always think you need to be able to tell visually. And, visually you would look, you'd stick a spoon in there and it would be thickened up. Now, it won't be thick like Greek yogurt. This is a new phenomenon.
Yeah, what's up with that? What is Greek yogurt? Why is it so popular, and what do they do to it to make it be that way?
That way? Well, they just drain the water out of it to make it that way.
So they make it more custardy that way.
Yes, yes. And why it's more popular is my guess would be that it for many people it seems more like ice cream or something.
Okay.
Yeah, or custard or flan. But if you make yogurt at home, it's not going to be thick like that. It's going to be
a little more watery, more like kefir. Like kefir.
Yeah, like
what's the difference between yogurt and kefir?
Well, kefir is a very special thing, and it, And one reason that I don't, I like to talk about the fermented and cultured foods that I could probably go to the grocery store and get the ingredients to make. And as far as I know, most grocery stores don't carry kombucha mothers, and they don't carry kefir grains, which look like little tapioca things stuck together.
Right.
So you have to do some homework in order to get those kefir grains. And then kind of the same thing applies as with the yogurt. Is instead of putting a little yogurt in that warmed milk, you're going to put the kefir grains in there.
It's a little more unique type of starter, and it creates a slightly different fermentation process, different flavor, consistency, and so on.
Yes, and probably different bacteria, although I couldn't name them for you.
Okay.
And probably the easiest thing of all is just to make some kraut, which all you need is a knife and some cabbage and some salt.
Some people use presses. Do you have to have a press? I used to have a press, and it had like a sort of a screw top that it tends to contract, and I'd kind of revisit and say, it's going down. I'll it was like is like a thumb screw kind of thing, like a medieval torture. You'd each time it contracted, you'd go a little further with it.
Right. No, I like to just make it on the counter in a wide mouth glass jar and. I just
without a weight on top to push down on it.
Well, actually, if you take a smaller jar and fill it with water, you can use that as a weight on top.
Okay, to press down on this top surface.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have a ceramic crock, not with all the contraptions, just a crock, and you can put a plate and a clean rock in there and achieve the same thing. But I'm usually making about 2 quarts at a time, and so... just using those big wide mouth quart jars works just fine.
By the way, I got to say, I got a busy Manhattan lifestyle. I spend a lot of time seeing patients, doing podcasts, and I do take the shortcut. Fortunately, I live in a part of the world where there are a lot of really great health food stores, and it's pretty expensive. It's much more expensive than conventional sauerkraut, but you can get, quote, live sauerkraut, non-pasteurized, at health food stores here in Manhattan, probably most major metropolitan areas. They're doing it more and more, but it could set you back, $8 or $9 a jar. But it's more economical to make it at home.
Yeah, the thing about these foods, though, is the actual time that you have to devote to being in the kitchen and using your hands is short. The magic thing is that it's the time that you're not touching it or doing anything to it. That's when it happens. So, for example, I make a loaf of sourdough bread every week with a starter, and I'll put the basic sponge together at night.
So let's distinguish, because a lot of people are concerned about bread partially because yeast. They're allergic to yeast. Yeast is a very allergenic substance for people who have candida or the yeast problem. But so you can make bread using a non-yeast starter, which is sourdough bread, and that's a bacterial starter as distinguished from a yeast starter, correct?
Well, there's still yeast-like things involved. Mm-hmm. I think if you're sensitive to yeast, I couldn't say with authority that that a sourdough starter would be, it'd be better, but not completely devoid of yeast.
Okay.
Because when you're making the breads, the natural yeast that are in the air can float on down in there. Yeah, but the beautiful thing about the sourdough is that it takes care of the problems that people have with gluten, because it breaks down the gluten, making it easier to digest. It actually breaks down the peptides, and it activates enzymes like amylase and protease that help you digest it.
But the one thing you don't get that you get from yogurt or that you get from pickled vegetables, you don't get live bacteria when you eat the bread, because obviously the cooking process annihilates the bacteria, correct?
That's up for grabs.
Okay.
I actually have found some articles recently that are showing that killed bacteria have some beneficial properties as well.
Interesting.
Yeah, so because, of course, you cook tempeh
yes.
as well.
Yes, okay.
So, yeah, so I'd say that's inconclusive.
Okay.
But there's a little bit of evidence that shows that you may still be getting some benefit from it.
Well, you know, it makes sense because actually some of the strongest substances that enhance the immune system are from killed yeast or killed fungal byproducts. Polysaccharides that are broken down by heating but not completely destroyed. The organism isn't alive, but these are polysaccharides that enhance immunity. And they're the basis of products like HCC and other types of immune enhancers. So maybe there's something to that, you know. And
We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know. I mean, think about the fact that bacteria probably landed on this planet from a meteor. So we don't actually know what heat and cold, you know, to what extent it can kill everything or not.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless, you get such a benefit from using this sourdough starter to make the bread because it just makes the bread, the ability to digest the bread.
You almost make me want to start eating wheat again. I'm almost there. If I talk to you for a few more minutes, I might give it a try again. But
I have a double dare with all the myriad of gluten free. I always say, come to my house. Let me give you a slice of my bread. Because it's so beautiful and it tastes so good. And I think understanding that the way that most breads are made that you buy at the grocery store are indigestible, and that they're usually pumped full of vital wheat gluten in order to speed the process up. So they actually have more, like, 4 pounds.
They're supercharged. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there was also that lovely study that was done last summer where they actually traced the gluten-free intolerance, and the line, the upward curve, perfectly matched the increase in the number of pesticides that are used on wheat.
Right.
So it may be, you know, and I'm buying organic wheat. I actually go to the farmer's market because we have some local farmers that produce their own wheat. And so I'll put my double dare back on the table.
Okay. All right.
Plus, I mean, is there anything better in the whole world than fresh sourdough bread that's just out of the oven? Oh, my goodness.
With natural, you know, slathered with natural organic butter. You got to add that part.
Exactly. Well, or, you know, what I do is in the morning I'll poach an egg, and then I put a big gob of my Latin American curtido kraut in there, and boy, that is some good stuff.
Hmm. That sounds amazing. What about kimchi? Kimchi, real popular these days. I happen to live in a town where, in fact, my office is not located too far from Koreatown in New York City. They own a vast amount of real estate in Midtown Manhattan, lots of Korean shops and restaurants, a big Korean population. And kimchi is easy to find here in Manhattan. Maybe it isn't too easy to find in Dubuque, but that is a live source of live culture. And our nutritionist, Layla Mudin, recommends it often to our patients to replete their GI flora. What about that?
Yeah. Oh, kimchi's beautiful. And if you come and look in my refrigerator, I always have a jar of kimchi and a jar of kraut and a jar of creme fraiche and sometimes yogurt, and then there's the sourdough on the table. So it's happy times here. But yes, kimchi is along the same lines as making kraut. It's slightly, just very slightly more complicated in that you have your cabbage, and you actually brine it for a little bit and in salt water, and then take it out. And then you actually make this paste in like a Cuisinart out of tons of ginger and tons of garlic and something in there for the bacteria to eat. So, uh, the Koreans sometimes use kind of like a rice paste, but I put apple in there. They like that just as much. And so, you
so it basically is a source of simple sugars.
Yes, yes. So there's apple and for it to grow on, and then there's lots of ginger, lots of garlic, and some onion, and then however hot you want to make it. You know, if you
right,
want
lots of spices,
hot,
sure. Yeah.
Well, a pepper would go in there.
Right.
But I don't necessarily need it real hot myself, but the ginger and garlic are pretty exciting. And then you basically take that brined cabbage and what other vegetables you want in there, like carrot or daikon, and then dress it with that paste that you made. And then the same thing, you just punch it into jars and make sure the liquid goes over the top layer and let it set. Yay.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah,
One other technique that I used to use in my macrobiotic days is I would get a big crock pot, you know, like a clay pot, and a ton of miso, live culture miso, and basically bury a bunch of vegetables in there. And what lent itself best to that process was daikon radish, carrots I remember putting in there. Is that a plausible way of fermenting your vegetables? You're making miso pickles, in effect.
Yeah, that sounds great. You make me want to try that.
All right.
Yeah, that sounds great. I think that's the beauty of, one of the beautiful things about making it yourself. And I'm going to be speaking at the Nutrition and Health Conference in Arizona in May that Dr. Andrew Weil puts on every year. Mm-hmm. And they assigned me to talk about fermented foods. And I assigned myself then I'm going to speak about why. Why in the world would you want to do it yourself? You can buy it.
Right.
And again, it would be, not only do you add your own signature bacteria from your house and your hands and everything goes in there, but you also get, like we were talking about before, you get the benefit of the developing bacteria at various stages. It's not a
not a freeze frame. You're getting it at different stages.
Freeze frame. Yeah, that's a good word. And also, you get to control the flavor. So some people like kind of a young kraut, for example, because it's it's got a fresher flavor to it. And other people like it to get pretty soggy.
I think I'm more the hardcore type. I like it really,
really sour.
Yeah, way down the line, yeah.
Yeah, you get to decide, and you get to decide how salty you want it, or you get to decide how hot you want that kimchi to be, or you don't want it hot at all, or how much miso is in your miso soup, all those things. Then when you're doing those things, you're participating directly in your own health instead of having somebody else dictate that this is healthy for you.
Or worse yet, spraying Lysol and everything in your household and living in a germ-free environment.
Yeah.
Which is what we tend to do.
That doesn't happen in New York City too often.
Yes, it does. It emits the filth and and redolent odors of New York.
I'm not saying it's dirty. It's just got a lot of culture. I lived there for over a dozen years, and I miss it every day.
There's a lot of culture, but the wrong kind of culture. I think we've got a lot of ballet, theater, and the arts, but we don't have a lot of live organisms populating our gastrointestinal tracts anymore. I think we need more of your homespun advice to get New Yorkers healthy. So, it's interesting that you are highlighted as a speaker at this conference in Arizona, because you are situated amidst eminent scholars and medical doctors who are going to weigh in on esoteric aspects of integrative medicine, alternative health, and the centrality of repleting our gastrointestinal tracts with live foods is so highlighted by the fact that you are a featured speaker at that conference. I think that that's great. It's a very important contribution to our overall knowledge about how to get healthy. So good stuff.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm flabbergasted and honored. But, I've been making this stuff for such a long time. At Bastyr, we teach a core course that's called Whole Foods Production. And it's an hour and a half lecture and then a 3-hour cooking lab. And everybody that's a nutrition major has to take it. And we have a lot of other programs, the students in programs that take this course as well. We offer it, I think, 8 times a year, which is a lot. Excuse me. And for years, way before all of this got popular, what we've been teaching is that when you design a balanced meal, let's say you're designing a balanced vegetarian meal, you need to have a whole grain, and you need to have a legume or a soy food, and you need to have 2 vegetables, and one of them needs to be green. And the fourth thing that needs to happen is that you have to have what we call the digestive element. So there has to be something raw, fermented, cultured, or pickled along with the meal. And we've been requiring students to design balanced meals like that for over a decade before all this got popular.
And I think that that's really a great way to look at it, because it's, you know, when we look at the ideal plate, fermented foods certainly deserve a considerable proportion. So what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? Where can people get more resources, find out about you, find out about fermented and cultured foods?
Yeah. Oh, there's so many things. Well, they can find out about me I have my own website, CynthiaLair.com.
And your last name is spelled L-A-I-R.
It is. Thank you. And then I also have an online cooking show with the funny name Cookus Interruptus.
Okay. I'm not sure if I should ask how you got to that name.
Oh, sure. You can, though. And it's because... and we do a lot of, there's 170 videos, and we do a lot of recipes from my books in the videos. And in the videos, there's a family, and during the cooking lesson of the video, the family come in and bother me about whatever, this and that. And it's all improvised, and so there are some pretty funny moments in there where I'm just making fish tacos or whatever, and you know, my grown daughter comes in and tells me I don't know that, where, you know, can I go pick up her son or something like that, you know, just very normal mundane family things. And you're like, well, why would you do that? And the reason is that several things. One was I wanted to really normalize healthy eating so that it looked like any family that's got the problems, everyday problems that every family has, can get some food on the table, and it's not that big of a deal, food they've cooked themselves. And the other reason is that healthy eating has gotten this piousness around it, almost sanctimoniousness around it, that I kind of wanted to punch through as well. And by calling it Cookus Interruptus and allowing there to be a lot of humor around it, I was hoping to make it normal and funny.
So it's kind of like a hybridization of Julia Child with Modern Family, you know, to try and make it real.
Yeah,
that's good.
Yeah, exactly. We used to call it Everybody Loves Raymond meets. What do we used to call it anyway? But yes, you've got the idea. Yeah. So it's a lot of fun.
Versus 50 Shades of Fermented, something like that.
Yeah, 50 Shades of Fermented, yeah. And then I would recommend for people that are really interested in fermenting food to begin with Sandor Katz's book, Wild Fermentation. My copy looks like it's been hit by a truck. And it's small and it's doable.
Sandor Katz?
Yeah, K-A-T-Z. And
what's it called again? I'm sorry. Please repeat.
It's called Wild Fermentation.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, and Michael Pollan's latest book, Cooked, he does talk quite a bit about fermentation. And being the superb journalist that he is, he does cite a lot of the most recent research that's been done. So if that's what you're more interested in, is, well, how are these things made and why, and, you know, that kind of all that. How
the science and the anthropology of it. That's great.
Yes,
good stuff.
Thank you. You're just making all the best words. So, yeah.
That's how I roll. That's how I roll, Cynthia. That's what I do for a living. And this is probably my, 20,000th podcast. So that's what we do. We haven't lost a guest yet in our entire career. And you have eminently represented yourself and the paradigm of fermented and cultured foods. So this concludes today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to offer you congratulations and thanks for your pioneering work and helping to get the word out about the health benefits of these important food types. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, our guest Cynthia Lehr, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Thanks for joining us.